Om Parataya Pratibhutitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Gratitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitam Ratavarshinim Bhagavatim Ashadashadhyayinim Ambatvam Anusantitami Bhagavad Gita Bhavadvaishini. Verse 11, chapter 9. Avajananti mam mudaha. Avajananti mam mudaha. Manushintanamashritam. Manushintanamashritam. Parambhavam ajanantaha. Parambhavam ajanantaha. Mama bhuta maheshwaram. Mama bhuta maheshwaram. Avajananti mam mudaha manushim tanum ashritam param bhavam ajanantaha mama bhuta maheshwaram 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 maheshwaram. Shankara introduces this verse. He says, Evam, mam, nitya shuddha buddha mukta swabhavam. This is nitya shuddha buddha mukta swabhava, mam. So he says, I'll tell you a minute. Sarva jantu nam atmanam api santam. He says, in this manner, having unfolded all of this satya mitya, I just unfolded so much about Prakriti and about my being the very self of the Prakriti from whom the whole creation comes, is sustained and resolved. So he's got several verses now talking about this. So now he says, in this, even though being in this, being like this, even though being in this manner, being what my swabhava, being nitya, timeless, shuddha, pure, Buddha, Jnanam, Mukta, ever liberated. So this Nitya Shuddha Buddha Mukta Swabhava, mom, even though my being this way, this is my Swabhava, it's timeless, pure consciousness, you know, timeless, pure consciousness, which is ever liberated, Mukta. Even though that being my nature and being Sarvajnam, omniscient, bringing in the whole Mayupada, even though my being is both limitless, pure consciousness, which is ever free, and Sarvajnam, all knowledge. Means for the Maya Upadhi, I am all knowledge, pure consciousness, pure jnanam. But from the standpoint of the Maya Upadhi, everything is known. The Maya Upadhi is a limitless expression of jnanam, because there's nothing, as Ishvara, there's nothing in this creation that is unknown. So that's why your Ishvara is called Sarvajnam. Just like if you have a thought, if you have an imagination, if you have a dream, whatever comes manifests, you know, as the manifestation of that Maya. Whatever it is known. From your individual standpoint, whatever thought is there, it is known. The thought is known as long as it's manifest. Creation is the same way. The creation is there, and the creation is manifest, it is known. That's why we say Ishwar is Sarvajnaha, where Swamiji uses the term, this creation is manifest knowledge. So here, Krishna says, even though I am this way, and even though being this Atmanam, even though being the self, the Atmanam, even though being the self of Sarvajantunam, of all beings, and being the self of all beings, you know, that self, I, even in this manner, even though I, you know, am the self of all beings, right? Of all of the beings, I who am Sarvajnam, who am limitless knowledge, who am Nitya Shuddha Buddha Svabhavam, still, even though that being the case, then he says, now the verse, avajananti mam mudaha, Those people who are mudras means they're still bound by ajnanam, they're still bound by ignorance. If they are bound by, if an individual is bound by ignorance, then the person is by naturally mudaha. Mudaha is in the nominative plural. They're naturally deluded in that, bound by that ignorance, they see this creation to be, and themselves to be, something that they are not. So they're deluded, totally deluded in reference to yourself. Deluded is a type of, in a way, insanity. In one verse, Krishna says, you know, I'm the jnani is sane and everybody else is insane. But then, of course, the jnani's in a minority. You know, but when you think about it, insane in this, you can say it facetiously, but actually what does it mean to be insane? It means when you take everything to be what in fact, everything in the creation, all of your experience to be the opposite of what it actually is. It means you're totally deluded, you're mudaha, you're totally lost in terms of the creation. Everything that you think to be the case is absolutely not that way at all. You know, because what is night for the jnani, for the one who has knowledge, is daytime for the ajnani. You know, what is daytime for the jnani is night for the ajnani. Everything is what we say. Everything is absolutely ulta. So say in this case for one who has knowledge, you know, one who's not mudaha, for one for whom that ajnanam isn't there, my being is nitya shuddha buddha mukta swabhava. Swabhava means my nature is timeless, you know, timeless consciousness. It is nitya, what is it? Nitya shuddha buddha. Timeless consciousness, which is pure, free of any ajnanam, you know, and which is mukta, is totally liberated. That's who I am, limitless consciousness. And I am the self in all beings. And this whole creation, I am sarvajna, because this whole creation is my manifest knowledge. That's who I am, you know. But if I don't have knowledge and I'm just experiencing this creation, like the dream character in a dream, or a character in your meadow imagination, or as a person here within this limitless creation, then I'm looking around at this creation, taking myself to be a conscious being within it. If I take myself to be a conscious being within the creation, then I have to be something that exists within the creation, which means I'm limited by nature. In this body, mind, sense organs, existing within this infinite creation. And so I'm less than a speck. I'm a speck within a speck within a speck within this infinite creation, subject to birth and death, seeking amana ananda outside of myself. And so here, what Krishna says, and these two verses are looking at the kind of negative side of things. He says, people who are mudaha, those people that don't, because they don't have knowledge, they are naturally bound within this delusional frame, you know, totally delusional frame. So you have to just think of your dream. You're the Ishwara of the dream, but the characters in the dream, right? Or the Ishwara of your meadow imagination, but the character in the meadow imagination has no clue. Their whole relationship to reality is one that is not the way things are in reality. So that's mood. That's what they mean by mood. Muda is the natural effect of ajnana, self-ignorance. So those who have this delusion, they avajananti, mom. They avajananti means they totally disregard me. They have no value for me whatsoever. They disregard me. I don't really exist for them. I'm meaningless to them. I don't mean anything to them. They discount me, disregard me, those mudas. They disregard me, who am what? Manushim tenum ashritam, abiding, placed right there in the human body. Manushim means human. Manushim tenum, body. I, who am residing right there in this human form, as their very being, as their very truth, satyam mitya, I am their very truth. For all of the jivas abiding here, those who are deluded, they totally disregard me, discount me. In fact, there's avajananti, there's a negative. It's a disregard that has some disrespect or discounting nature to it. It's a negative term. term. They pay no attention to me. They disregard me. They have no value for me at all. Right? I, who am the me, they disregard me, who in fact am abiding right there, right, in the human body. Why did they do it? He says, param bhavam ajananta, because not knowing param bhavam mama, my real nature, my supreme nature. Param means the nature which is true. Param means, if we're to translate param, I mean define param. Param, you know, you translate it as supreme. Who likes that word? Nobody. Param, the supreme nature. Param means desha kala vastu aparichedha. Desha kala vastu aparichedha. My nature, which is aparichedha, it's not limited or circumscribed by desha, by it's free of place. Kala, it's free of time. It's not, it's mukta. In terms of place, it's not bound by place. It's not bound by time. It's not bound by any object. Param means limitless. My nature, which is limitless, it's free of time, it's free of space, it's free of objectification. All objects, a vastu, when you say a vastu, it means a thing. And in the world, if we translate the word vastu, it means anything, subtle or gross, that I can experience. It's a vastu. It's a thing, T-H-I-N-G. Look it up in the dictionary, vastu is a thing. But in reality, the only vastu is Brahman. So the word vastu will resolve into Brahman, because as we analyze the creation for a thing, we find names within names within names. There's no such thing as a thing. Right? Because everything is divisible into smaller things. So Swamiji will say everything is really nothing but a name. And that name is divisible into names. So names within names within names within names. We name something. We name something and we say this is a thing. Actually, all it is a name. Because as you analyze this so-called thing, you just find names within names within names. So we start with desha kala vastu aparicheda, that which cannot be limited by desha, space, kala, time, or vastu, thingness, objectification. That is param. That is my param bhava. That is my mama means my supreme nature, my limitless nature. When you say Krishna can't really say, he says mama, my. He's talking from the standpoint of this upadi. Like if I were to say to you, my real nature is limitless being. That's my real nature. So where's the my here? In Advaita, there's no my. There's just Satchitananda. There's no one to have the Satchitananda. There is only Satchitananda. So if Krishna is saying my real nature, my true nature, he's talking from the standpoint of the upadi, his Krishna upadi. So he says, not knowing my true nature, and what is my true nature? Bhuta Maheshwaram, as the Maheshwara, means the Supreme Lord, the Lord that is the Lord which is limitless, the Lord for which there is not another Lord. So if you say Maha Maheshwara, Ishwara means God, it means the Lord. Maheshwara means the Lord of all Lords. There's no other Lord. There's no Lord beyond this Lord. So I am the one who is the Lord of the whole. I am like the Nimitta Karana. I am the conscious being from which this whole creation has come. I'm the Maheshwara of all of the Bhutas. Bhutas means of the elements and elementals. Elements are the space, air, fire, water, earth. Elementals are everything else. These upadis, they're all elementals. Right? They're all of the, in the physical world, all of these, you've got the space, air, fire, water, earth elements. You've got the maha bhutas also, which are the subtle elements. And then you have the elementals, which are all of these elements going into combination on the subtle and the physical level. So the bhutas, the Lord of the bhutas, means the Lord of the entire creation, all beings, as well as all of the elements from which these beings are all made. Like, for instance, you as a jiva, you are made, your sukshma sharira is made of the mahabhutas, the elements that have not gone through panchikarana, right, that have not become fivefold. The elements and the elementals are, means these mahabhutas coming into combination, like your antakarana. Your mind is the five, you know, the five subtle aspect of the subtle elements, whereas the sense organs are just one subtle element, made of one subtle element after another, like for, I'm not going to go do this whole thing. I can see Andrew going, oh gosh, we're not going to spend the whole class on this. No, we're not. But I'm just saying, when you say, I'm the Buddha Maheshwara, you know, I am the Lord of you know, the Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas, that project as the five elements and the elementals. Everything that makes up the jiva is part of the Buddhas. Everything that makes up you is a jiva, you know. So I am the Lord of this whole thing, you know. And, you know, that the one who knows my nature as being really the self, the limitless self, Brahman, the Satchitananda, the conscious being with Maya, the one who is the truth of this whole thing. Like, I can say that about, I can say, as I'm a little Ishwara, I can say, if I say, I am the Maheshwara of the meadow I've imagined, the meadow imagination, I'm the Maheshwara of that. What does that mean? I'm Satchitananda plus the Maya Upadhi that is capable of that manifestation. I'm Ishwara. I am the Ishwara. So I'm taking into account, you know, I am the Lord, right? I am the Lord of this whole Maya. So you can appreciate for you, if you say you are the Maheshwara of all of the Buddhas, all of the elements involved in your meadow imagination, right? You are Brahman, the Satchitananda, the Parambhava, you know, the Satchitananda with this Maya capacity. That's who you are. And so now, that being, the Satchitananda, the conscious being that I am the one, so Krishna's talking, you know, you don't know, not knowing, you don't have knowledge. Say if you don't have any knowledge, then you don't recognize that the very self that's abiding in your body, as the conscious being that is abiding in your body, right? Abiding here, in your sharira, the manushim tanum, and here in this sharira, the very conscious being that's abiding in that, that self is me. And that is my true nature. That conscious being is my true nature. And my true nature was what? This conscious being, you know, the Parambhava, which is the Lord, which is the conscious being, who is the Lord of the entire creation. So the conscious being, which is abiding in the human body, which is abiding in your body, conscious being, which is abiding in your body, is me, who Krishna is saying, is me, that is not knowing this Parambhavam, this the true nature of myself, as the Lord of all beings, you then don't pay any attention to me, right? And you don't recognize that. You don't recognize me as being the self that is abiding in your body. You discount that. You pay no attention to that whatsoever, right? If you don't have knowledge. If you're a mudaha, you're a mudaha if you don't have knowledge. It's not your fault you're a mudaha. You just are. You need to become, you as a mudai need to become a mumukshu, right? Until you're a mumukshu and gain jnanam, you're muda. And if you're a muda, you're not definitely not paying any attention to me. Because you don't recognize me as the self in all beings, as the Lord of this whole creation. Okay. So now let's go to the next verse. So he goes on to tell him what your problem is. What's the problem of the mudha? The mudha's problem. Mogasha moka karmanaha. Mogasha moka karmanaha. Moka jnana vichetasaha. Moka jnana vichetasaha. Rakshasi masurim chaiva. Rakshasi masurim chaiva. Prakritim mohinim shritaha. Prakritim mohinim shritaha. Mogha shaha. Mogha karmanaha. Mogha jnanaha. Vichetasaha. Rakshasi asurim chaiva. Prakritim mohinim shritaha. This verse is followed by another verse, which is Rakshasim. The Rakshasa is really, in Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas, is the person who has a Rakshasa nature, is the person who's of the three gunas is predominantly rajas. The asura is the person whose nature is predominantly tamas. And then in the next verse, we'll look at the person who's the three gunas, their nature is predominantly sattva. We'll see. So this is going to be looking at the rakshasa and the asura. What they say is moghashaha, moga ashaha. You say it all in the plural. The persons whose asha, their hopes and aspirations are moga. Moga means useless. They won't amount to anything. They're in vain. You know, you have hopes and aspirations, but those hopes will not lead to any type of a fulfillment. Like, say, if you want to say, you know, but say if you remember when you were a teenager, poor thing, just starting out in life with all of your hopes and aspirations and thinking about what you would like to be when you grow up, or, you know, what you want to accomplish. Say, you know, you're a young person, you're thinking all of the things that you want to accomplish and what you want to become and all of these type of things. And often those aspirations are totally existing within the realm of samsara. In other words, in order for me to, there are aspirations where I will be a successful, whole, complete, full, happy person. I will have made it in my life if I can accomplish these things. And then I have my laundry list of things that I would like to accomplish. I hope I can have that. I hope that I can, you know, end up having this, or I hope I can have that. All of those type of aspirations that are really focused on time-bound things are in the end moga. They will not pan out in terms of giving you what you are actually seeking. And then again, moga karmanaha. And there's a way out of this, but anyway, moga karmanaha. Also, all of my actions that I do to accomplish all of these things, my hopes themselves won't give. What I think the hopes will give, they won't give. They give momentary happiness, but they don't give any type of lasting happiness. And then the karmas, all of the actions that I do in order to achieve these things also are not going to result in what I was hoping they would result in. Moga karmanaha. Swamiji says, for these two, let me just go back. He says something interesting. The mogashaha can be just as I've just said, you know, these hopes and dreams. They themselves are moga. They also are, they're not going to bear fruit. The fruit that I hope them for them to bear, you know, if the locus of the aspiration has to do with anything in samsara, because anything with samsara is only going to be a momentary fix. That's the idea there. He says this moga ashaha can also mean I am not making use. He's using it more as grace, maybe because of the next verse. I am not making use of the grace that I've been given to have a human birth. The human birth is considered to be very, very, very rare. A tremendous amount of punya that's involved in having a human birth. And without, as it we'll see, without the mumukshutvam, or working for antakarana shuddhi, or having a value for liberation, this moksha, without making use of having a body, mind, sense organs, and a mind that is capable of viveka, you know, a mind that can think, a mind that can discern, without making use of having this human birth, which takes so much punya to get, you know, then that grace that I've been given, taking now asha as grace, has been in vain. It's a second way to take it. Okay. So taking it as the asha, as the very grace that allowed you to take this human birth. You know, when you think of it, this is how the Viveka Chudamani starts with these famous verses, that it takes crores and crores of punya to get a human birth. Then when Swamiji goes on about this, he'll say, when you think of all of the jivas in this, just in on this loka, in this creation, when you start adding together all of the insects, all of the plants, all of the insects, you know, all of the creatures, the insects, the creatures, the fish, all living creatures are jivas. This human, to have a human birth, is so rare. You know, when you look at all of the other species and that, then add in all of the other little insects, the mosquitoes, etc., having that human birth is so, so very rare. And so to get a human birth and not make use of it, your human birth, which is takes such grace, is just in vain. And then he says, moga karmanaha, karmas, and all of the karmas you do, all of these karmas, you know, themselves, if I'm doing this as just to fulfill my raga dveshas, my likes and dislikes, I want this, I don't want that, which is normally what karmas are being done for, all of those are also in vain when these karmas, you could be using these, doing these karmas to gain antakarma shuddhi, where the karmas that you do are actually for the neutralization of your likes and dislikes. So you're using all the karmas, karmas in terms of the Vedic rituals and the Vedic dharmas. So you can do Vedic rituals, for instance, they're called karmas. You know, you can do those in order to fulfill your desires here on this level, or to go to heaven worlds. You know, or you can just be doing, not even in reference to the Vedic karmas, you can just be fulfilling, doing karmas in order to fulfill your raga dveshas. All of those karmas are in vain. They're not going to give you what you really seek and what a human being is capable of achieving. The purusharthas that we have are dharma, artha, right, kama, artha, kama, dharma, and moksha. Artha, we do all kinds of things for security. There is no such thing as security, but we do all kinds of things, you know, to gain security. We do all kinds of things. If we have a meaningful level of security, we do many, many things in order to gain pleasures, all of which are momentary, you know, to gain happiness through kama, through the fulfillment of desires, with the fulfillment of raga dvesha. Dharma, we do dharma in order, this is from a Hindu perspective, we do dharma in order to get a better next life, to go to heaven worlds and get a better next life. Now, once we get to the dharma level, at least we're a vaidika. We believe in God, we believe in dharma, we believe in punya papa, we believe there's something besides just this physical world. We still would have artha and kama, but we also have dharma. But we're still totally caught within this creation, so we're totally caught still within samsara, but now we have some Vedas. In the end, you need to seek moksha. So he says this, moga jnanaha, even your knowledge, your education, it is also useless unless your education in the end converts over to becoming a jignasu. If your education brings about that maturity, spiritual and psychological and spiritual maturity, then your knowledge will convert into moksha, the desire for liberation, for jignasu, the desire to know really what is going on. You know, now say you're studying science, or studying finance, or studying anything, whatever you're studying religion, in the end your education should push through to this really realizing the limits of your knowledge. In other words, the more you study, the more you realize that you don't know, and the more you realize that you also can't know. That you can't know. All your knowledge is really doing is releasing for you more ajnanam. The more you know that you don't know. Like Swamiji's example I always like of a light. Say I have a light that's just a little laser beam. The circumference or the diameter of the light, your little laser beam light, say it's like an eighth of an inch in diameter, your laser beam light. And so look at the circumference of darkness that laser beam light is lighting up. The circumference of the darkness around the laser beam is very little, really, because the laser beam is little. So now say you decide, let me get a flashlight. Laser beam is strong, but it doesn't light up very much of the darkness. So let me get a flashlight. And now the flashlight is like 2 inches in diameter. Right? It's 2 inches in diameter. Now look, it's a bigger light, all right, but look at the circumference of darkness it's lighting up. It's much more. The ignorance it's lighting up is much more. Now get one of those huge, you know, those lights that they use in the stadiums, a huge light.
Spotlight.
Big spotlight. Now look at the circumference of Ajnanam that's being lit up. The most humble man is, there's a lot of shlokas like this in India. The most humble man is the pundit. Because the more you know, the more you don't know. Maya is within this creation, the more you light up, the more you light up, the more you light, right? Of what you don't know. And so your jnana, your pursuit of knowledge itself is in vain. There's no end to it. There is no resolution to your knowledge to where you can say, now I know. It's not possible within Maya. So knowledge will not ever fulfill itself. In fact, you'll just become more and more humble, realizing what you don't know. The only knowledge that fulfills itself is self-knowledge, where, you know, you know what is the truth of all things. And that one thing, you know, is known completely. The only thing you can know completely is something which has no parts. Then you know it. There's only one way to know it. You can't know it from the right side or the left side or up or down or back or sideways or in between. It's one non-dual self. So that knowledge, let your relative knowledge lead to maturity, to know, you know, to ask the real question, you know, to know what is the truth of all of this. So moga jnanaha. So for those people, they're, as long as your knowledge or your karmas or your aspirations stay within duality, they cannot complete themselves. They cannot resolve themselves into what you're really seeking. And for all of those such people, they are, what are they? They're vichetasaha. Those people, at this point, they do not have viveka. They're not able to discriminate. They don't recognize, they're not using their viveka. So they don't realize the limitations of the samsara in terms of their hopes and aspirations, in terms of their karma, in terms of their actions, in terms of their knowledge. If their knowledge is leading them to viveka, then that knowledge is not moga. Right? If the knowledge leads to maturity, to viveka, it's not useless. If the karmas are done for antakarana shuddhi, to neutralize likes and dislikes, they're not useless. If this body, if we could say, if the hopes and aspirations are toward moksha, not useless. Or if we take it in terms of the grace that you've been given to even have this physical body, if you're using it to gain self-knowledge, then it's useful. If you're not, it's not useful. It's not useless, in fact. And that when a person is in that state of not making use of what you've been given, then he says, such people are shritaha. They're abiding in... They have taken to a nature, a prakriti, their nature, which is a rakshasa nature or asura nature for such people. And besides that prakriti, they're bound by that moha, bound by that nature, and they're bound by the moha. So what's a moha means delusion. Because of the ajnana, what is a rakshasa nature? The person who has a rakshasa nature is the person who's ruled by rajas. The person who's ruled by rajas has a lot of energy, but an energy to accomplish what I need to become happy. And what I need to become happy has to do with what is out here. So the rakshasa is the person who's ruled by rajas is considered to be an angry, this is their negative qualities, an angry, aggressive, me first. The asuric nature is, in other words, the rajas nature is I'm thinking of the Republicans right now.
sorry.
But it's really...
It's true.
It is really, you know, what is good for me? What is good for me? And, you know, really, what is good for me? And Swamiji is very rough on, but he didn't say Republicans, but he's very rough on this in his bhasha here. He says, you know, destroy this person, kill this person, get rid of that person, they're in the way, let me get what I want. Shankara says this in his bhasha, not just Swamiji. Swamiji's talking about what Shankara is saying. You know, cut him down, kill him, destroy him, let me have what I want, I need this. That's the rakshasa. Rakshasas, you know, Ravana was a rakshasa. Then there's the asuras. The asuras are... Swamiji elaborates on this, but Shankara also says this. I will eat whatever I want, even if they're running around you. Swamiji cannot... You know, if you're not a vegetarian, there's really something wrong. How can you eat animals? They're running around, the poor little fish, they're swimming, the animals, they eat anything. An asura will eat anything, they'll drink anything, you know. And he gives an example in his, this is the example he starts out with the asuras. He knows this one man that would take yogurt and put it on a shelf for 10 days before he would eat it. Oh, and by the time he was ready to eat the yogurt, it stunk. It stunk so badly. That this is what an asura will do. This is an asura. Eat anything. You know, eat anything, drink anything, slothful. Asuras are considered to be very dull, slothful, lazy, just fulfilling sensory gratification. That's considered the tamas. Okay? The rajas is considered not that. Tamas, the... Excuse me.
I thought maybe there was tea in there.
The rajas is very aggressive and even violent, whatever it takes for me to get my way, to fulfill my desires, that's what I will do. That's the extreme rajas. Extreme, the tamas is, you know, I mean, we all have a little rajas and a little tamas, but this is if you were just to say, okay, this person is the embodiment of rajas. This person is the embodiment of tamas. And so the tamas is dull, slothful, sleeping all the time, fulfilling themselves by eating and drinking whatever they want to, sensory gratification, dullness, and sleep. That's tamas. Rajas is much more aggressive in terms of fulfilling desires. So these people who have no viveka, they haven't made use of their knowledge for it to mature into jignasa, the desire to know. They haven't made use of their karmas to neutralize, karma yoga, to neutralize likes and dislikes. They haven't made use of this body and buddhi to use their viveka. So these people who are vichetasaha means they don't have a mind. They're not, vi means here, they're vigata. They're not using their mind. They're not making use of their mind. These people then can take to a prakriti which is either born of rajas or born of tamas. And the other one is the one who's prakriti is dominated by sattva. And those people are the mukshu. So those folks we'll do next time. Okay. Just stay with the negatives today. The positive, get back into the positive one next week. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurupyo Namaha Hari Om.
Question. The term Prakriti,
we've
used as a synonym for Maya and also as the nature of something, or the...
Yes, that's true. The something, nature itself, you can say. Someone's nature. Not the nature of something, but someone's nature is sometimes called Prakriti. Like it's your very nature is the Prakriti. But then when we look at the Prakriti, what is really the nature composed of? Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas. So we can look at Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas as being that's what's responsible for the elements or the elementals. But we can also use the Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas. And so that's your nature. You're made of that Prakriti.
Okay, so it's using that.
That way. Mm-hmm. But also, there's qualities, like say if the mind is dominated by rajas, dominated by tamas, or dominated by sattva, we're using it as qualities also. So your mind, if we say your mind is very sattvic, for instance, then it has the qualities of sattva, which is that which reflects consciousness, is still and pure. Rajas is that which is active, so that active principle is then used as energy, but also as agitation and anger. You know, and forcefulness. Tamas is used for the material elements, but it's also used for slothful in terms of qualities like slothfulness, dullness, lack of any type of mental energy, not wanting to think, that type of thing. You'll really see that when we get into like the 14th chapter and 16th and 17th chapter of the Gita. They start looking, they talk about sattva, rajas, and tamas as qualities. Like you should only eat food that is sattvic. It means that food that contributes to a mind that is has a lot of shanti. Avoid rajas foods. Avoid rajasic foods, tamasic foods. So they get into looking at the world in terms of these qualities.
During the meditation, it's pretty clear to me how the intellect can integrate the mind. But this process of the unconscious getting integrated.
Yeah, because that's when you come into conscious relationship with the unconscious. Right? If you don't come into conscious relationship with the parts in the unconscious, they just remain as they are forever. They look exactly the same over and over again, causing the same pain, the same problem.
Yeah, worry, you know.
Yeah, worry when you have not come into relationship of what it is in the unconscious that's overwhelming the mind. You haven't come into a conscious relationship with it, then it just keeps getting triggered over and over again, the same thing. But when you come into a conscious relationship with it, then it can start being transformed.
Well, you have to talk. You have to talk to it then, or it's using the mind to go into have a connection with the unconscious. It still is fuzzy to me.
Well, we have to keep working on it in meditation. But there's different techniques. I do a lot with talking to it or coming into relationship, or say if all of a sudden so you're overwhelmed by worry, for instance. Mm-hmm. Then what happens was, say we're overwhelmed by an emotion, then the normal way to deal with that is to look around and say, oh, I'm worried about this. Right? We're filled with worry. So then you look around and you say, okay, well, what am I worried about? Okay, I'm worried about that, and I'm worried about that. So whatever is a little iffy, or that could be a, what do you call it, Trikut, trigger your worry.
Because the source of worry, it's related to the event, but the source of worry is...
Source of worry is not really related to the event, but the event is going to be the carrier of it.
Yeah.
And so say you suspect that.
Yeah.
You know, because you're just seeing that a lot of things are becoming the carrier of that worry, or a lot of things are becoming the carrier of that particular complex, of nobody loves me complex, or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
So say it's the worry. Then you can say, wait a minute, let me, the buddhi, right, just be with this worry and talk to this worry. Now you can say, so you can go and just sit with the worry, you feel the worry as though it's a person inside, or a child inside, and you say, tell me what you're really worried about. And then you listen, you let it talk to you. You let the worry talk to you. You know, come into a relationship with the worry itself. Or you're feeling very hurt. You know, and you know, it could be something that really out here that really deserves your hurt,
mm-hmm.
hurt feelings, but it could also be a feeling that's much more than, say, what that situation should really be triggering.
So when it feels deeper,
mm-hmm.
that's...
or it's continually coming up,
mm-hmm.
then you can come into some sort of a relationship with it. But then the thing is, what kind of relationship do you come to?
And
like if it's a critical relationship or a hateful relationship, you know, or one that doesn't have any love in it, then there is nothing healing about it. It will do no good. The part that might have talked to you is now gone deeper into the unconscious.
Yeah, that won't resolve.
Won't resolve anything. That's why, you know, in the end, what resolves the problems is love, and love and understanding very much go together. In fact, when I was studying to be a psychologist, I had as a supervisor this Jungian analyst. His name was Lauren Peterson. He's in Walnut Creek. So I used to see him once a week to go over the client caseload and all of that. That's what you do when you're becoming a psychologist. You have, you know, a supervisor. And so he was talking to me about love and how does love really manifest in the world. And he was saying, really, it's understanding. If a person feels understood, they feel loved. They feel really understood.
Mm.
And if you really think about it, I thought about that a lot, actually. I think there's so much truth in that. I'm teaching, and you should really be in class. You are? I don't see you there. How come I don't see you? Okay, it's too late now because I'm ending. But anyway, call me later. Okay, good. I'm just teasing you. Okay. It's Kristen. She's trying to get online. I don't know why she can't. She's too late for us.
So, where were we now?
Huh?
Understanding is love.
The understanding, if you think about it, you know, when you feel understood, you feel seen. It's a wonderful thing when you feel, it's a wonderful thing when you feel really understood by somebody. You feel loved by them. He was talking about in terms of, you know, being a therapist, because I've studied to be a therapist. When your client feels really seen and understood by you, that's a great thing. I mean, for any of us, you feel like somebody really understands you, you know, and that's just such a helpful thing. And so now, with what attitude do you come toward these unconscious parts, like the part that's so worried, for instance? If the buddhi comes with wanting to know, wanting to understand, you might not understand right now, but your whole intent is to understand and to help. Then the parts of you that are having trouble now have an inner friend. And in that relationship there can be some transformation. And that's why it's so important. And then what I said later in the meditation is that the self is really the inner friend. And so it, in truth, because that is the source of love. That's the true source of love. And I was thinking of it like this. The self has the self is plus Maya is Ishvara. The self of the Maya is Ishvara. And so it's almost like the self as a little avatar in a way. comes as the inner friend, internally I mean, to be with you in the form of the buddhi, right? Because the Atma itself is the love. It is the wholeness. And then when the buddhi takes on that position of being the inner friend, the one who cares, who wants to help, you know, then that buddhi has taken on is the most healing then. There's nothing more healing than that, really. But in the end, that buddhi, when the mind is taken care of to a large degree, then the inner friend, the buddhi having to take that position of being an inner friend, is, it's not a matter of it taking that position anymore, because that's just how it is. That is the nature of the buddhi, and that is the nature of the self. The buddhi is an inner friend just by nature. It is a friend by nature. It's a friend externally and internally by nature. That's as your knowledge becomes assimilated.
So we're going to be doing some meditations or some more work with that?
We can always be doing work with that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's all part of it.
Because, seems like sometimes you can really notice the unconscious affecting you. Certain kind of attitudes or responses to events, kind of.
Oh yeah, of course.
But it feels like a history. I mean, you know,
it's habitual, but that's why we have to bring in this other.
But a history not necessarily even created by this jiva, I mean this upadhi, but you know, maybe from
some scars, it could be
long ago, you know.
Yeah,
I mean there's a mixture.
Yeah, or it also could be like when you're very, very young, and there's no real thought process going on, where the little baby isn't able to say, you know, this is happening, this is happening, and this is happening, but all of these things are happening. The trauma of the parents, for instance, the baby is being held in the trauma of the parents.
Mm.
You know, and so it's internalizing all of those feelings, but of course there's nobody there to really understand that. It's just happening. You're being held in that, you know, and suffering it. So that's why sometimes we say, as a therapist, when you're working with clients, they'll have feelings that they have no idea. They have no words for it at all, but they have very much the feelings. Well, you know, what happens to you before you have words? You still have feelings. I mean, children have feelings. They still have experiences, but they have no words for those experiences, but they're overwhelming experiences. You know?
Kyle, where did you get those words, the Swabhava words? Because that's not...
Swabhava. Oh, no, that's in a couple of lines in the Sanskrit, before the verse.
In the commentary?
Yeah, yeah. You were going on and on.
It's in the commentary.
It's in the commentary.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
It's the two lines that Sanskrit that introduce the verse.
Oh.
I do that once in a while when I think, oh, this is kind of nice.
It was nice,
yeah.
And then I was looking, where did you
get that?
Yeah. I actually really like it when you do the
is it in
the
Swamiji's
commentary.
A few things, yeah.
I like it.
Is it in this thing? Okay.
Because you can read Shankara's commentary. I mean, you can.
I can.
Pretty amazing.
Yeah, but it would... That's a Saturday class.
Yeah.
That's not because it can get very tedious also.
Oh,
but what I can and do like to do is sometimes Shankara has this wonderful sentence.
Yeah.
And you can, oh my gosh, he said that.
Yeah.
But it's amazing because you think it has something to do with modernity, some things that are said, and then you see Shankara saying it so clearly. I don't know, it's just amazing.
But why did he say it? Why did he say it before this verse? He just
Because remember, in the beginning, we've been talking all about Prakriti and Ishwara, you know, and Prakriti being my Prakriti and all of that.
Uh-huh.
So now he says, in spite of that, that reality, mudaha, people who don't have knowledge,
mm-hmm.
you know, not knowing my nature.
Right.
They totally disregard me, who have abided here in this body.
It's a funny thing to say, they disregard, because you can't really disregard something that you don't
disregard,
know.
No, disregard's not quite the... I can't get the quite the right... It's,
you said it had a little bit of a negative.
Yeah, it's not disregard in that way. It's almost disrespectful.
Yeah.
There's a word in my mind, and I can't think of the word. Therefore.
Who did it?
Because it's
time?
Just on the tip of my tongue, and I was looking for the word, and I couldn't find it. So,
ignore
is closer.
You can't, again, ignore, you have to know something before.
It's not
bigger than ignore, isn't it?
No, it's not ignore, it's not disregard, but it's that with a, just a minute, I'll tell you, okay? I'm sure they'll have it. To have a low opinion of, despise, to treat with disregard. But disregard in this sense, to have a low opinion of, to despise, to treat with contempt. That's not quite right, but it's like if you're saying something to me and I just disregard everything you're saying, you know? It's not disregard in the sense of not knowing, but it's like, here you are, but I'm not paying any attention to you. You know? I'm disregarding you.
Dismiss?
Yeah, it has a more of a sense of dismiss. No.
Well, it's not very common.
I don't pay any attention, you know?
It's kind of like they don't inquire. They don't wonder.
They don't wonder at all.
What is going on?
That's right. You're there.
Yeah.
But I pay no attention to you at all.
You don't wonder. You just assume, like, this, I'm this, this is this, that's that.
Yeah. So there's no inquiry at all.
Yeah.
No attention paid, no inquiry.
Most people.
Swamiji always talks like that, where he can be around certain people for years and years, and they never ask him a Vedanta question or anything about Vedanta.
Yeah, but think of, there's that. But think, okay, say we're in this room, and all of us are talking together, and having a really kind of, you know, we're just hanging out and we're together, but nobody even looks at you.
I mean, there's one person.
Here we all are, right? We're all talking, carrying on, and having a conversation. But there's one person in the room who it's as though he's invisible or something. Mm-hmm. Nobody pays any. He's there. He's right there. Nobody pays any attention at all. You know, that kind of disregarding, because here I am. I'm totally, totally here.
Yeah. What about me? Yeah.
But nobody makes any reference to me whatsoever.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm actually the Lord of this whole creation. Really, you know? It's amazing.
I'm the big dog in the sky, you know?
I'm the whole.
Yeah, you rattled those sentences off pretty good, and then I was thumbing through the Swamiji's.
Oh, you were looking to.
Yeah, you know.
He talks about, he hasn't translated that sentence. That's not his thing, is not a translation of the Shankara, but he incorporates and expands on whatever Shankara.
Well, Swamiji will quote Shankara's sentence, and he'll say, Shankara uses this sentence all the time. And
yeah, that's true. That's right.
So, we're going to work with the unconscious a little bit.
A lot.
A lot. Okay, good. Okay. That integration.
It's the big special understanding that you have. Your value system is pretty set for how you want to be able to treat people. We don't always live up to it, of course, but the value system is there. But it hasn't been properly turned inward. You don't include yourself in the people. The people are the beings, living beings. You have a good value system that you try to live up to and all toward people, but you don't treat yourself as one of the people. You know, and so your unconscious actually gets your shadow side in a way. You know. The way you would never treat anybody else. is taken out on yourself sometimes. You don't even realize it. So in psychology we'll say, you know, start, this is just a big deal, start listening to the way, to the self-talk, the way you treat yourself, the way you talk to yourself, and see, is that how you would like to treat others? Do you have a value for treating others in that way? You know? Because you should be, enjoy that same, be part of that same value system.
Yeah, there is that too, but you know, like you said, some of it's formed before, or maybe out of life, past lifetimes, and there's not a language there, or...
Well, you have a language though. You have a language to feel, to label worry as worry. You don't know where'd all that worry come from, but you can start being with that worry, you know, and then try to help it to grow and transform. But if you don't take the time to be with it as a friend, as an inner friend, then it's just kind of stuck there and it'll just keep manifesting. You know, whenever there's an appropriate trigger, boom, there it is.
Your old friend.
Yeah. Rumi has some beautiful poems about that.
Hmm. Welcome friend.
Rumi.
Oh.
The friend.
Yeah.
And Hafiz.
Hafiz, yeah. Yeah, another amazing poem. Okay, let's stop.